Good afternoon. I'd like to first thank you for taking part in this interview between Thomas Grobb and Lord Owen on the 29th of January 2008 at Curzon Square, London. Firstly, could you just describe your political career to date?
I mean, I've been a member of Parliament since 1966, and I was Minister for the Navy in the Labour government from 68 to 1970. I wrote a book called The Politics of Defence, which was published in the United States and in Britain in 1972. I was defence shadow spokesman, junior shadow spokesman in opposition, and I resigned over the European Union controversy inside the Labour Party with Roy Jenkins. When Labour government won the election in 1974, in February, I became Minister of Health and remained there until August, September 1976, when I was asked by Jim Callaghan, who'd come in as Prime Minister, to go to the Foreign Office, where I was the deputy to Tony Crossland, who was the Foreign Secretary, with the specialising in Europe, European Union. And then in 1977, tragically in February, when Tony Crossland died, I was appointed Foreign Secretary, and I remained Foreign Secretary until Labour lost the election in May 1979. When Labour Party in opposition moved its policies from that which it pursued in government in a very extreme direction, including coming out of the European Union without even the referendum which Labour had given the country in 1975. This was in 1980, and also endorsed a stance of unilateral nuclear disarmament, and even began to question the nuclear deterrence of NATO at one stage, and changed its economic policies back towards much greater degree of state nationalisation. I did not serve any longer in the shadow cabinet when Michael Foot was elected as the leader of the party on that programme. That was in the autumn of 1980. And in January 1981, when the conference, it's a special conference, passed a resolution for an electoral college, believing those policy changes which I mentioned earlier would not change for 10 to 15 years, I left the Labour Party, and with Roy Jenkins, Shirley Williams and Bill Rogers, established the Social Democratic Party. I was the deputy leader of the party after Roy Jenkins was elected, and prior to that, a leader in Parliament. And then after the 1983 election, I became the leader of the SDP and stayed the leader of the SDP until after the 87 election, when the party voted for a party for the party to merge with the Liberal Democrats, which was against my advice, so I resigned as leader of the party. And feeling I couldn't negotiate on behalf of the whole party when I was not going to join any such merged party. And when the party, new merged party was formed, three Social Democratic members of Parliament, myself, John Cartwright and Rosie Barnes, continued as SDP members of Parliament. And we tried to keep a party in the country. Initially did quite well in the first by-election we fought at Richmond, but eventually we both ran out of money, members and support, and so the party was wrapped up in 1990, and I did not contest the 1992 election in the dissolution honours list. I was made a peer as Lord Owen of the City of Plymouth. And then in a few months later, I was asked to be the EU representative in the International Conference of the Former Yugoslavia in late August 1992. This was somewhat surprising, since I had advocated to John Major a more military role for NATO in interdicting the Serb supply lines in a number of public statements in July of 1992. I then remained as chairman of the international conference, along with Cyrus Vance initially and then Torvald Stoltenberg, until I stepped down from that in May of 1995. I was the joint author of the Vance-Owen peace plan, which was sadly in effect kiboshed by the American administration, which was the only one of all the different plans for Bosnia-Herzegovina which was not based on partition and was hopefully to keep the country together. I was then with Torvald Stoltenberg, mediated the EU action plan, which was not supported by the Americans either, in the autumn of 1993, and we both, Stoltenberg and I, helped the Five Nation Contact Group put forward its proposals in the summer of 1994. Again, this was with the Russian support and the France, Britain and Germany, and in this case, importantly, American support, but none of these countries were ready, as I suggest they should be, to impose a settlement on the Bosnian Serbs. And eventually it was pretty clear that there either had to be a change of attitude in America on the use of force, since the Europeans were not ready to use force on their own without the Americans and wanted to do it through NATO. And this sadly only took place after the collapse and fall and massacre of Srebrenica in July 1995, which was after I ceased to be a member of the chairman of the International Conference on the Former Yugoslavia. I supported the Dayton Agreement and I supported military action in Kosovo reluctantly, in the sense that they were not ideal solutions but they were the best of the alternatives, and I have remained in the House of Lords as a crossbench or independent MP. That means not associated with any political party. And today I do business in America and in Russia and in the UK and speak in the House of Lords from time to time on foreign and international affairs.
On to the subject of Anglo-American nuclear cooperation. What, in your opinion, do you think Britain benefited in your times?
Yes, Britain benefited massively. I came first involved in this when I was Minister for the Navy in 1968. I inherited, therefore, the Polaris Agreement and the decision to build Polaris. And I was involved in the Polaris, the fitting out of the submarines. I went to a Dasso firing off Cape Canaveral. I think it was an HMS Renown. And I was responsible, under Dennis Healy, the Secretary of State for Defense, for all matters related to the strategic nuclear deterrent, Polaris. And I've ever since then been really very interested in nuclear policy. I formed a close friendship with Zolly Zuckerman, Lord Zuckerman, and that friendship remained. And when I became Foreign Secretary, he was still working a little in the Cabinet Office, and the Cabinet Secretary and the Prime Minister agreed that he could become my personal advisor on all nuclear questions. And he advised me on the comprehensive test ban and the strategic arms talks, and on the question of Shevelin, which was one of the big issues that we faced at that time. We inherited a Shevelin modernization of the warhead, the Polaris submarine, but its cost was going out of the window. I eventually agreed with Fred Mulley, who was the Defense Secretary, to support, in contradistinction to Dennis Healy, initially at least, he opposed it, the continuation of Shevelin, because I felt that to cancel it would leak out and it would therefore act to the detriment of our deterrent in terms of the Russian Federation, the USSR, which in those days was still a pretty difficult enemy. And I, however, made it contingent, my support for it, in the summer of 1977, that it was nothing to do with the need to retain the so-called Moscow criteria. Throughout my period as Foreign Secretary, I challenged the need for the British deterrent to take out Moscow and thereby have to penetrate their anti-missile defences. And I believe that it was sufficient for a minimum nuclear deterrent for the British, that we would be able to hit a number of major Soviet cities, particularly those associated with a military-industrial complex. And I preferred, anyhow, targeting on military targets and not on civilians. There was a controversy in the four of us who used to deal with nuclear questions, the Prime Minister, James Callaghan, Defence Secretary Dennis Healy, Fred Money, Defence Secretary Fred Money, Chancellor Dennis Healy, and myself. And eventually it was agreed that we would continue with Shevelin despite its cost escalation, but we would establish a working group of officials called the Duff Mason Report Group, who reported back, and their feeling then was there would be an election probably the end of 78. Anyhow, there wasn't an election, and they reported back to us in December, I think, of 78, and as soon as their report reached us, and that was the civil servants' report, there had been no ministerial input, no involvement of the Foreign Office under my guidance, because it was known this was an official's report. And it was really to help and guide an incoming government, whether it be Labour or Conservative, in 78, 79, when there had to be an election. As soon as the document was published, I was out of the office and I gave instructions, because I had already prepared in my own think tank in my private office, helped enormously by Paul Lever, a counterblast to that document, because we knew they were going to support the Moscow criteria. We didn't know exactly how far, and we also knew that they would come out in favour of a ballistic weapons system and dismiss the case for a cruise missile alternative. And I argued the case for the cruise missile alternative. I should make it clear that I didn't argue it on the grounds that it was a better system. I thought it was a more affordable system. If we were strong and rich, we could afford to continue in the ballistic missile business. But it struck me that the Shevelin experience had indicated that we were not really up to doing these extensions and greater sophistications of the warhead of ballistic missile systems. That even though we were buying the American missile, we were still, under the terms of the agreements post-war, responsible for the warhead. And that was too much for us. It was just beyond our technology and also fiendishly expensive. And so I thought that we should settle for a nuclear deterrent that we could afford. I had been briefed by the ambassador in Washington, who I had appointed as a political appointee, Peter Jay, about the effectiveness of the cruise missile, which was being disparaged by the Ministry of Defense, and indeed downplayed deliberately by the U.S. Naval Department, because they wanted to go for the Polaris successor, Poseidon and Trident, and they did not want to boost the alternative case, which was the cruise missile. But they knew, and people in Washington knew, that it was setting out to be a very effective weapon system with extreme degree of accuracy. Anyhow, the Callaghan cabinet discussed that in the end of December, the Myra paper, as well as the Duff Mason report, made no decisions on it, and it was agreed that it would be a decision for the incoming government. But because Jim Callaghan was going to meet with President Carter, and he had a very good relationship with him at Guadeloupe, it was agreed that Jim Callaghan would sound out, without prejudice to any decision for an incoming government, what would be the President's attitude to having the same sort of agreement on Polaris missiles that we'd had be extended for a new generation of missiles. And Jimmy Carter was very forthcoming and promised that could be done. And prior to leaving office in May, Jim Callaghan made available to Margaret Thatcher and wrote to her all the minutes of the, told her about the Duff Mason report, said that would be there for her to make her mind up, and also told her about conversations he'd had with Guadeloupe. I think that Jim Callaghan behaved with honour and with probity. He didn't feel that he had a mandate from the last election to continue with a new missile system. We had a mandate to modernise and update the existing system. If he had been elected Prime Minister, he never made any secret of the fact he would have tried to persuade the Labour government and would have been able to persuade the next Labour government to go for an updated system, as the incoming government of Margaret Thatcher did. But he did not make any final decisions. If you like, he prepared the ground because he knew that a new government would have to make that decision fairly soon, within a few, three or four months, which is exactly what they did. So that was the position. And one other thing that is worth mentioning is in 1978, when Jimmy Carter let it be known to us privately that he was minded to make a statement about no first use of nuclear weapons, that Jim Callaghan reacted very strongly against such a proposal, as did the Chiefs of Staff, and as did I and diplomats concerned with NATO. We felt it would give a very bad message to NATO at that time. It would be very divisive. It would have fed doubts about our capacity to stand up to the Soviet nuclear modernization program that was already underway with the SS-20s and the Pershing missiles. Not Pershing missiles, the SS-20s, there was one other one. Anyhow, the SS-20s main thing. And although we'd not made any decision yet on Pershing, or that was to come later, it was clear that we were going to want to respond, and Schmidt had made that clear already in a good speech in London given to the ISS, and I agreed with every word of it, and I thought that it was necessary for us to respond. But if we'd had a no first use pledge, that would have raised very big questions. I had already independently in the new group of nuclear weapons argued against the early use of nuclear weapons, and had wanted to get rid of some of the tactical nuclear devices that we had, because I thought they were extremely dangerous. So I was sympathetic to the concept of no early use and having that built into the strategy. But I was in favour of having uncertainty, and I believe that people, the Soviets with their very substantial conventional forces, should not think that they could make an attack on NATO forces without, at some stage, and not immediately, but at some stage, having a nuclear response, and that they should fear a nuclear response earlier than we would probably actually, in fact, authorise it. It was decided between Callaghan and myself, really but predominantly by Callaghan, that there would be no sort of complete blanket. He would not discuss this collectively with ministers. And I took over to America with me a handwritten letter from Callaghan to Jimmy Carter. I think it's a very good example of where a prime minister has a good working relationship and indeed, a good deal of affection in his relationship with the President, as Carter had with Callaghan, and Callaghan had with Carter, that they could have a private exchange. The British could use their exercise their influence quietly, not even be known to its European colleagues, and that Carter listened to those objections and decided not to go ahead. Whether he changed his mind on the proposition, I rather doubt. I think he just decided that if he couldn't have the support of the British, it would not be worth putting a proposition on the table. I think it's too greatly to Carter's credit that he did it, didn't do so. And I think it's a very good example of how a Prime Minister can conduct relations with the President of the United States quietly, privately, but making very clear a detailed and a serious basis against it. And he consulted with the Chiefs of Staff on the wording of the letter, and he consulted with me on the wording of the letter. But very few people knew inside the British government. I think probably 6 or 7 people, 10 perhaps at the most, knew about the existence of the letter. And because it was kept private, it was much easier then for Jimmy Carter to climb down and not go ahead with it. But equally, it was courteous of him to inform us, and we didn't have the speech made out of the blue and suddenly then having to either pretend that we liked it or try and alleviate our criticisms. That's really all I have to say about nuclear weapons. I've watched, of course, very carefully since then, and my views on nuclear issues have not really fundamentally changed. I should just say that, and I did reveal in the House of Commons the other day, because the papers were in the National Archives, that during the discussions on Chevalier, I was never told that the Chief of Defence Staff, Carver, in 1975, had told the then Secretary of State for Defence that we were not able to penetrate Moscow. And all through the time when I was arguing against the Moscow criterion, the most that we were told was that there was some doubt about whether or not we could penetrate Soviet missile defences. They never came clean and told us, which was categorically stated by the Chief of Defence Staff, that we did not have the capacity. And indeed, he looked at the targeting strategy and there were some changes considered as to how to alleviate, how to make it a little more chance of being able to penetrate the Moscow defences. So for at least 6 years, and probably 7, during the 70s and just into the 80s, Britain did not have the capacity to penetrate ABM defences. And I think this is something we should give very serious consideration to. It was actually not something we had at a time of serious confrontation with the Soviet Union. And I'm not convinced myself whether or not the arguments about ballistic or cruise missiles, and that's largely one of the expense. But in terms of political need, I do not think it's necessary to be able to penetrate any ABM defences that the Russian Federation may or may not decide, or China may or may not decide to put around their major cities, their capital city. It's extremely unlikely that either of them will. And even if they did, it would be more than just Beijing and Moscow.
As Foreign Secretary, how did you envisage Britain's role within NATO? What was it?
Or do you want me to tell you that I think we should support it? I mean, it's an alliance which brings Canada and America across the Atlantic. It's a thoroughly important thing for us. America nearly pulled back its forces in 1946. We needed America in 1918 to complete the 1914-18 war. They were very late in coming in, but they did come in eventually and put troops in. In the last few months of the war, they were a very important addition to our forces. And we waited on tenterhooks for them to come in to the Second World War until, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it is worth remembering that America did not declare war on Hitler. It was Hitler who, 4 days after, on the 11th of December, declared war on America, something which Churchill noted at the time, he thought was the worst decision Hitler had made throughout the whole war, which one assumes meant that Churchill also thought there was a possibility that he might not have done so. And if he had not done so, one wonders whether America would have come into the war. So it seems to me, in the past experience of the need for American forces in Europe to gratuitously send them home or to do anything to encourage Americans to go out of the Atlantic Alliance would be absolute folly. I've always thought the Atlantic Alliance should look beyond Europe, and I was in favour of out-of-action NATO way before it was eventually agreed, and I'm staggered to find that we are now seeing NATO deployed in Afghanistan. I think it's a very good thing. Whether or not we can succeed in Afghanistan is a quite different question, and the manner in which we make that contribution. But I think the fact that NATO is operating worldwide and as illustrated by Afghanistan is a very fine achievement. So I'm solidly in favour of NATO, and I think we have worked out the problem which everybody has when working with America, that America does not accept that its armed services can go under the control of anybody other than an American president and an American general. And we have got working arrangements within NATO which allow subordinate commanders to operate over and above American forces, but with them content that the overall wish of Congress to remain totally free of any outside national limits on their exercising of their vital national interests is preserved. Now, therefore, to get rid of this structure, which is as solves these, to get rid of the proven experience now of actually fighting wars with Kosovo under our belt and Afghanistan, seems to me to be great foolishness. So I'm a strong supporter of NATO today in 2007. In 2008, as much as I was when I first came involved with the issue when I was a young student in 1960-61, Checkpoint Charlie and the Cuban Missile Crisis, 62.
Do you see much hope for nuclear disarmament ever becoming a reality between the two nations?
What do you mean by nuclear disarmament? Do you mean the abolition of nuclear weapons? That's a very difficult thing to do. It's a perfectly decent aspiration. Sometimes you aspire to things which you don't necessarily think you're going to achieve. I would love to see a world in which there was no more poverty, no more people dying through lack of medical care. I'm not going to see it in my lifetime. My children aren't going to see it in their lifetime. It doesn't mean you don't aspire to it. I think that it was a pity that the nuclear war weapons genie was ever let out of the bottle. But it was, and I think that having got it out, putting it back will be very difficult. But that does not mean that we should not do so. Anyhow, we are signed up to do so under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the nuclear weapon states, part of the quid pro quo of other countries not becoming nuclear weapon states, is that we would do more. And that is certainly something which I think Britain should contribute to by slowly and steadily getting our nuclear weapons down to a minimum. And then if we can get ours down to a minimum, and the ones of China and Russia and the United States down to a much reduced level, we could consider giving up nuclear weapons, but it should be a collective judgment, and I think it's pretty unlikely. I think Europe will not develop nuclear weapons. Germany has decided not to develop nuclear weapons. They obviously have the capacity scientifically and financially to do so. Japan has decided not to do so. I think the European Union will never have a nuclear weapon, hopefully never be a single state. And in the meantime, France and Britain should cooperate as much as they can to spend their euros and their pound sterling as cleverly as we can. This is an expensive business being in, and at the moment our defences, our forces are greatly inadequate on conventional. So we've got to be very careful about spending too much on nuclear, because it basically comes out of the same pot.
On the actual subject of replacing Polaris, is any serious consideration given to cooperation with the French about producing?
There has been discussion, started under Ted Heath, minimal discussion under the Callaghan period, but it's a generalised discussion. I think they've got back into it occasionally since then. I think in the old days, when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, there was some informal understanding between France and Britain about targeting, nothing very specific, but broad understanding of where, which country, which areas, which country would focus on. So there was some reduction in potential overlap, but it was very informal, and it was done between the chiefs of defense staff with the knowledge, if not the formal acquiescence, formal acceptance, but acquiescence of their political leadership. But it's not formalized. Maybe that's how it will continue to be. It matters a bit less now. We don't have a specific enemy. But in discussing how to respond and getting some measure of agreement as to how and in what circumstances France or Britain might ever contemplate using nuclear weapons, it seems to me as two EU countries we should have a fair measure of understanding and agreement, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to extend that to understanding and knowledge without their participation in the sense of being decision makers, because they don't want to be decision makers, but letting them know how we see things with Germany. And of course we'd be doing that anyhow with the United States under the agreements that we have over targeting.
Did the MDA treaty ever come up as an operational issue with the release of the arms?
The MDA? The MDA would be what?
Mutual defense agreement.
Between us and who?
The United States. Was there any separate law there? Or was this just...
Well, we go back to many different agreements, don't we? We go back to ones that were during the wartime, then the ones that were swept aside in 1945, then reinstated in 46, 47. I'm not sure what that particular one is about, but I mean, it's well known that the British Prime Minister and the new President get together and come to some understanding about nuclear weapons, and particularly the use of British American bases in Britain. But it's very informal, and informal is not the right word. It's a very delicate question because, again, Congress has an absolute that nothing should in any way reduce the freedom of American defense policy to respond as they think suits them best. So you will never get some formalized agreement. Well, you won't get some written treaty agreement between us, but you'll get confidences which we, successive British and American governments, have felt binding on each other.
As a historian, have you any chance of finding the full story of British nuclear history just through the documentation alone?
Well, I'm not what I really call a historian. I'd love to be, but I write from time to time on these matters. There is no particular one single book. What's her name? Mary Ginsley G is written very well. What?
Mary
Gunn. Yes, that's right. And now I've read with interest some of the recent work that's been done by a person who used to be at Swansea University, is now at... Yes. I think he's written some very good stuff. His PhD is extremely good. And has, in fact, found documents published in the archives which the government are deeply embarrassed about, trying to withdraw at the moment. I think his... I hope his thesis is published. I think it's very... What? As it's been published, is it?
Yeah.
Actually, good. Who's published? I mean, he found out the business about Mike Carver and all those things. And you can't leave this issue not studied, because what that demonstrates is that a chief of defense staff and a defense secretary, with certainly the involvement of the permanent undersecretary of defense, and it's not quite sure, but it looks a bit as if the involvement of the cabinet secretary were responsible for not letting two prime ministers know in detail about the their findings. Callaghan, Wilson first and Callaghan. That's mighty serious. And to have a conversation in the Ministry of Defence with the Ministry of Defence through the Foreign Secretary and the Chancellor of the Exchequer without them known, and actually deliberately conniving to not let the Chancellor of the Exchequer know, because they were fear he would use that information to cut the Trevelyan programme. Now, we all have to have secrecy, but we also live in a democracy. And if the secrecy can reach such a level that you actually stop getting in an effective decision of the democracy, I still don't know whether anybody in the Foreign Office knew about the Carver finding. And certainly I was never told about it, which is, if the Foreign Office knew, it would be absolutely deplorable. And somebody needs to find out. Somebody needs to do some more research. We need to know these things. But they're hastily trying to cover up and trying to remove the documents from the National Archive. I don't know whether they have been removed yet or not. Well, I hope these have not been removed. There'll be a hell of a row if I find they have been removed. If you let me know, I'd be very grateful. But all these things still out found. I mean, if they make a mistake and put them out into the public domain, that's their affair. But if they wish to withdraw them for national security grounds, it's one thing. But to withdraw them for political embarrassment grounds, they know all this. I've already asked for them under the Freedom of Information Act. But how can I find out whether these have been withdrawn?
I've only seen a pre-production copy of Stoddart's work, but in a lot of his footnotes he talks about things being redacted, now they've been withdrawn and stuff. So I guess we'd probably best speak to him about it. Or maybe the National
Archive. Well, I think this is absolutely scandalous. I have these documents, I would reveal them if they didn't. Okay, but I think it's very, very bad. And there is to be too much secrecy about this. A lot of this is gooey. And there are certain things that need to be kept very quiet, but not much. I think that it's a little bit of an improvement that the government decided to have parliamentary authority for going to the first stage of Trident. This business of making the parliamentary decision to conduct the design studies for the submarine and the feasibility studies on the various options for missiles and for weapons. I hope, and I think it's very important, this debate that took place largely as part of a rather sort of premature search for a legacy by Tony Blair before he left, that it should be taken on face value of what was actually said. I mean, that was not a decision to go for Trident. It was a decision to take the first stage, which was to go to the studies. And Parliament would have to be consulted before we can actually go and spend vast sums of money on something to build.
Thank you very much for your time.